Hey, welcome to Athlete on Fire. I'm Scott Jones, your host, and I'm pretty pumped with our guest today. Really quick, guys, if you've never listened to any of these interviews, if you've never been on the podcast, you can find everything at athleteonfire.com. We interview adventurers, athletes, and entrepreneurs all over the world, and the goal to bridge the gap between them and the rest of us. And whether it's just learning exactly how they did what they did, or a process, a creative process, or otherwise, we just kind of tap into these amazing people. And some of them you've heard of, and some of them you have not. And today's guest I have heard of. I actually met him for a few minutes. We were both working an expo at the Fort Collins Marathon out here in Colorado with my wife's hobby business. And this guest was just launched a book. So I've had his book for 4 years. I read it a long time ago, and I probably forgot half of it. But just to give you a little background, he's run over 120 ultramarathons, averaging about 125 miles. He's done 12 expedition-length adventure races. He's climbed the 7 summits. He's done some crazy stuff, guys. So we're going to dive into that. But more importantly, I'm gonna be the most selfish host in the history of podcasting, and I'm going to ask him things just about life stuff that might help me. And then we'll tap into the fitness and the nutrition a little bit, because that's his sweet spot as well. So today's guest, Marshall Ulrich. How are you doing, sir?
Well, I'm doing well. I really appreciate you having me on the show, Scott.
Yeah, me too. It's always cool having fellow Coloradans, because we can talk about the weather in detail and let everybody around the world know how awful it is here.
That isn't so much the case this winter, but sometimes it does get kind of hairy up here in the high country. But we certainly love Colorado and the climate, and it's very advantageous for training also.
Oh, my gosh. So you said offline, you're in Evergreen, Colorado. Just for people who are listening who aren't from the States or aren't from this part of the country, just paint a picture. Like, what is that little town like?
Well, it's at about 7,500 feet, and it's 30 miles west of Denver. So we're past the foothills in the proper mountains. So take, for instance, Mount Evans is, as the crow flies, maybe 8 miles away, so I can run trails all the way up to Mount Evans and get up to 14,000 feet. So it's, it's trees that, pine needle trees, and it's green year-round. It's just kind of a nice altitude where it's very temperate. Our temperatures very often are as good, if not even higher, warmer than Denver, Colorado, which is, a mile high. So, it's just a nice place to live.
Nice, nice. Okay, so there's some big themes with the stuff that you do. I mean, just pushing yourself. And we'll dive into the athlete part of your life here short enough. The show is Athlete on Fire, so that's going to make sense. Before we do that, if you guys are listening and you want to kind of follow along and learn more about Marshall after the show or during while you listen, go to MarshallUlrich.com, or you can go to his Facebook page, Marshall Ulrich. He does do some public speaking. He's a coach. He's got a book coming out in the fall, which I'm excited to check out. And we'll talk about that at the end, but I just want to get that out there. There's three tenets that I noticed. You wrote this on your website. I'm not reinventing the wheel here, but the idea of going too far and being too old and things not being possible and just trying to break people's mold of that. When's the first time in your life that you thought that you went too far or you're going too far in a physical sense?
Well, I think it was when I ran across America. I was 57 years old, and I was averaging just under 60 miles per day, and I had an injury, plantar fasciitis, at about 1,000 miles, and so I kept going despite that. But sleeping about 4 hours per night, it was just a little bit over the top, and that's one of the things, when I finished, it was like, this is people ask me about climbing Everest or, running across America, and it's like, nope. Would you do that again? Nope, never again. So it's that type of thing. That's sort of the test of fire. Whereas, like Badwater, I'll go out and do it again. It's fairly benign. You just have to train for the heat, and it's 135 miles. Or if you go to the top of Mount Whitney, 146, which, I've continued to do. But still, I keep going back. So it's extreme, but it's not that extreme because I go back and do it again.
Yeah. So ultra running is seemingly getting more popular. I mean, the numbers support that from events and stuff. I look at ultra running in a different sense for myself. I put on events. When I go up in the mountains, I kind of like to just I like to be by myself a lot. So, like, sure. Toeing the line often isn't my passion, but I see why people want to get into it. Stories like yours and Killian and, like, Scott Jurek, like these guys that just go do these really inspiring things. But my question to you would be, for somebody who gets that itch to go try something epic-ish, what are some good reasons to train and go do an ultra distance feat, and what are some bad reasons?
Well, I think the good reasons are it expands your horizon. It makes you think more along the lines that anything is possible, that it's very non-limiting and freeing once you get out there and do it, and you don't even have to do it well, but just get through it, and you know, it's a great success. So, you know, I think it's on a very personal level, you know, when a person succeeds in something, it just helps. You can look at it as building blocks where all of a sudden you think you can do more, and indeed you can do more. And if you push the limits, you start. For me, I just started thinking more creatively. It's like, you know, okay, I can go out and take, for instance, the Badwater Racer Mount, climb Mount Everest or something like that. But what it does is it expands the horizon. You know, how can I make this sort of a creative process? Thus, you know, I think you may know that I did a circumnavigation around Death Valley with a friend, Dave Heckman, and that was 425 miles. And we actually buried over 30 caches underground 2 months earlier and did it totally self-sufficient in the summer. So, you know, once you do something like that, it's like, oh my God, you know, I can't believe I did it. You know, you look back and think to yourself. So, you know, that's kind of the positive thought. I think it's very enriching, and it enriches your life, and those around you, you know, can't help but notice how inspired, you kind of inspire yourself as well. And if you do that, you inspire other people too. I guess the downside of it is, you know, it can be an addiction of sorts. And if you take it to the extreme, you have to be very careful. And this is just my personal view, that you don't start, you know, destroying relationships and getting things, you know, out of whack, because it does take, you know, a certain amount of time and a little bit more time to go out and train. So you have to be careful to prioritize your life in a positive way.
So I know you speak from experience, excuse me, on the addiction part of the running. And so give us a story. Bring that to light a little bit more on how that's affected your life as far as the endurance and affecting relationships or other things in your life.
Well, you know, a lot of it goes back to, most people know my story where I lost my first wife to cancer, and that's why I started running. And I didn't feel like I went through the grieving process. I just went out and started running, and, you know, I distanced myself enough to where I really couldn't connect with another person. You know, I'm speaking of the opposite sex, effectively for a good decade until I met my current wife, who sort of was very understanding, you know, realized what it was that I needed to do and was very accepting of who I was. So, you know, distancing myself from people really, you know, it isn't a healthy thing when you isolate yourself. And so, you know, just from a, you know, personal standpoint, the running shouldn't have taken the place of that. I should have dealt with that and stepped back and even taken a break and said, you know, I need to deal with this first, and then I can go back and start running in a healthy manner, on a healthy basis, I guess I should say.
So running almost becomes the medication in an unhealthy way, the coping skill. You know, like alcohol or drugs can be used for those coping skills. Was that a coping for you in
Yes.
an unhealthy way? Yeah,
absolutely. And, you know, medically it did, you know, as soon as my wife was diagnosed and I was going through that process of just watching her passing on, my blood pressure went way up. So it did, I did benefit from it in that, you know, it brought my blood pressure down to where I didn't have to go on medication. But then again, you know, it's a double-edged sword. It did other things, affected me in ways that, you know, weren't healthy.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of the coping skills, I've worked with a lot of youth in my career, and there's that sweet spot just after high school, into college, and then the first couple years out of college, especially, I think, from everyone I've met, where really learning healthy coping skills is important because it's going to set the table for the rest of your life, so to speak. So do you think that running, the way that you started running almost obsessively is the bad reason that a lot of people do? Do you think a lot of people run from things or because of things?
I do. And, I've got a good friend, Mark Macy, and he tends to think that, just about every ultra runner that is out there, and for that matter, some, marathoners and whatever, that, there's all sort of that addictive side of them, and that's how it manifests itself, as opposed to, as you had mentioned, alcohol or some other addiction. And I think there's a little bit of that is true. Maybe there's a few more type A individuals out there that are doing ultra running, and maybe they have a propensity to be, on the addictive side. I don't know that for sure, but I think there's some truth to that.
Yeah, no, I do too. So I have these themes written down. I have this little list right here on things I want to ask you. Just opinions, and I think the wisdom from just talking to someone that's older than me, has more experience, is interesting. So you mentioned the loss of your wife. My dad has had a hell of a time with his health lately. He's on dialysis. He's had a heart transplant in the last year. He was told when he was 25 that he only had 3 months to live from cancer. He's gone through all the chemo. He's a warrior. And, of course, I haven't lost him yet. He's still around. But you lost somebody really close to you. What would you tell younger people? What would you tell, maybe teenagers? And what would you tell 20-year-olds about loss and how to deal with it and what it really is to each different person,
Well, I think... I think the biggest part of it is I think the grieving process can be like a learned thing, but it's very individual. And I think it depends on how deeply connected we are to that individual too. Everybody does the grieving process in a different way, but I guess more than anything, pay attention to and acknowledge that, you're hurting. Just don't ignore it like I did, and just think that you can push through it without going through, there's basic steps there's a protocol to it. And I think there's something to that. And so I think it's just like when you're out there running, you pay attention and you sort of tune into your body and figure out what it needs. I think you need to do that with your psyche. And so if somebody is hurting out there, that you need to connect with that part of your, not only their hurting, but to be empathetic to it, but, connect with how you're hurting too and acknowledge that that's happening. Don't think that, you can just ignore it, I guess, and come out on the healthy side of it, that it's going to stick with you. If you don't do it right, sooner or later, you're going to have to do it.
Was there anybody in the world of sport and running that really reached out and gave you good perspective when you were going through that loss?
Well, I think, once again, my buddy Mark Macy, who did 8 of the 9 eco challenges with me, and, gosh knows that, when you spend a week out in the wilderness or 10 days in the wilderness doing one of these adventure races, that everything comes out, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we would talk to each other about that, and he would simply, I think more than anything, if you can find somebody who would just listen, I don't get too chatty or too gabby or don't reveal myself to a lot of people, but if there's somebody out there that you can partner with, that you can listen to them and as well as they listen to you effectively, then, that's a good, healthy part. And then, it just may be a word or two that they have of advice that somehow... in that hollow core, that state that you're in, that, they can break through that and help you.
Yeah. Well, I think there's never anything wrong with trying to help someone is struggling. Even most people are reasonable enough to know when to back off. But for people listening, this is really for people listening. If there's somebody that is struggling with something, like make that first effort at least. I think it's just really important to not be scared of those moments when there's loss or tough times in people's lives. It's just really important to make that effort. So, okay, let's go a little more positive with some of your endeavors. Now, Marshall, if we covered even a quarter of what you've done, this show would never end. So let's go on the circumnavigation of Death Valley. You said it was like over 400 miles, about 425. What goes into that? And training wise, what goes into that?
Well, you know, I trained for it basically the same way that I would doing Badwater. And in fact, I did Badwater and then started the circumnavigation a couple of days later. So, you know, the training was already in place for Badwater. And then an extension of that is it helped me to acclimate to the real deal, the heat of Death Valley, because I was submersed in it for a couple of days while I was doing that. So, you know, there's the, you know, taking the time to go out and train as you would. And, you know, that involved sometimes 60 to 100 mile weeks of running, as well as, you know, getting in a sauna and getting used to the heat of it all. But the actual event itself, it happened a couple of months before that, the planning even up to a year in advance, where, you know, we had to figure out a route that would weave us in and out of Death Valley National Park, because you can't be burying caches inside the park. So we had to go around the border and, you know, dive out to get our caches, and usually spend an overnight if we could at those places, and, you know, just figure out exactly what had to go underground, such as all the water we buried, 400 gallons of water, and there were probably 10,000 calories of food at each one of those caches. So, you know, it took a lot of planning, a lot of thinking, you know, what is it that we will need? The simplistic part of it was, as far as equipment was concerned, we had one set of clothes, basically a t-shirt that, you know, would convert it from a long to a short sleeve, a pair of pants that were convertible pants, pair of underwear, and a backpack, a sleeping pad. And that was about it. That's all we really had to carry. So, you know, some of it was pretty simplistic.
Yeah. How long did the whole thing take again?
It took 16 and a half days to do it. So we were covering right about a marathon. Sometimes we'd go up to 50K per day, which isn't a lot of distance, but the terrain varied from being on the road to being completely cross country and, you know, pretty well, very much out of sight and out of mind to just about everybody on the face of the planet.
How did you guys navigate? How did you mark your caches?
Well, what we did is we would mark them via GPS. Then we would triangulate, put flags on if there were some mesquite bushes or some rocks or something, we would put flags. And then we'd take pictures also coming and going, so we would have a wherewithal in case the GPS would crap out. But it was very interesting because it took us about a week to bury all these caches, and we would be, you know, working 14 hours per day and night, and we'd bury some of those during the night. And there were all but two or three of them where we couldn't just walk right up to them, even though the ground looked like there was nothing underneath. It's uncanny when, you know, things really count, you really pay attention. So, yeah, we used a lot of GPS coordinates.
Oh, that's why. So how hot, I know it was a hot year, but, like, paint a picture, how hot was it during the day, at nighttime? What kind of struggles did you have with the varying temperatures?
Yeah, it was very interesting because we thought, well, heck, we'll just sleep during the day, and then at night, you know, we'll go out and travel. And that was the worst thing that we could have done, because when you're in that stagnant heat, you can't sleep. So we found that even, take for instance, traveling at 3 miles per hour, we created a 3 mile an hour breeze. So it was more effective to actually travel during the day and then sleep at night when it did cool off. The temperatures varied from probably about 60 degrees at night, maybe 70 degrees, up on the northern edge because you can get up to elevations of 5,000 feet or more. To about, I think the highest temperature that we experienced was somewhere around 125, give or take a degree. And one of the most interesting statistics was, it was kind of funny because when we were in the southern part of the valley, the low 5 degrees, which was the highest temperature other than outside of Death Valley, that was the highest temperature during the daytime temperature anywhere else in the U.S.
Holy.
It was hotter at night there than anywhere in the U.S. the next day.
We were out in California when I was a kid, and I grew up in Florida, so I was used to heat, but not like that desert dry heat, right? And I remember I was like 12, 13, no, I was like 14, and I wore contacts, and we walked from the hotel to this movie theater, and I'll never forget it because it was so freaking hot, like standing on the side of the pool was not even doable. And we walked from the thing to the movie theater to watch Terminator, the original Terminator, and my contacts stuck to my eyes. It was so dry.
Yeah.
Just unbelievable. So from a performance standpoint, I mean, the attention to detail when your water is waiting on you had to be crazy. But how much were you guys taking in on a daily basis? How much water were you guys putting down?
We would usually take a couple of 200-ounce bladders. One is kind of a backup. So if something happened, we'd be okay to survive. But there was one stretch that was about 25 miles where we had to carry all of the water because we were in the boundaries of Death Valley National Park, as well as going through China Lakes,
airfields.
Testing. Yeah, air test. Yeah. So at that point, we had to start out with about 5 gallons each, which is kind of, that makes for a heavy backpack.
Yeah.
So, and it was just pure water. We'd take a little bit of salt. We couldn't really, every once in a while, we'd put, some flavoring in or something, which was a real treat. But the interesting thing, and this is kind of getting into the nutritional part of it, Dave sort of focused on a lot of the engineered foods, if you will, powders, stuff like that, energy bars. And I focused more on like canned goods, freeze-dried foods, real food, as much as we could get. And after about 2 or 3 days into it, you'd never guess, or maybe you would guess what we were eating. It was the
real,
it's regular food, real food.
I haven't done anything crazy. I think the longest I've done is like 35 miles in a day. But I don't know why. I guess from a performance standpoint, speed. But like if you're going to just enjoy distance and figure it out, you got to go real food, in my opinion. It feels more natural. Your body responds to it in a lot of different ways. Of course, some of the science, some of the stuff that's out there is fine. But from a taste standpoint, I hate having to choke stuff down,
Right. It's more palatable, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. So, okay, a couple more things on Death Valley, then we'll move on. But for people who are listening, is it a beautiful place, or is it an acquired taste? Like, what's your take on just desert in general?
Well, I think I either love it or hate it. Some people have no appreciation whatsoever. They just think it's, the god-awful worst place in the world to be. For me, it's probably the most pristine, the most peaceful, getaway place that you can go on the face of the planet. There's a lot of diversity out there. Take, for instance, Death Valley. You've got Joshua Tree forests. You've got mountains. You see rams out there, bighorn rams, all sorts of, diverse, hardy plants that can grow in that environment, which just, it blows my mind, as well as, geologically, it's just stunning. You've got sand dunes, you've got, desert, and once again, as I said, mountains. So, the diversity is just unbelievable. Plus, at night, sleeping under the stars, I mean, you can't get a better sky unless you're on the top of, say, Kilimanjaro or Mount Everest, a clearer sky than you see in Death Valley. It is one of the no-light zones in United States. I think there's less light there than anywhere in the United States.
Wow. Yeah, I love the
light.
The stargazing is just amazing in the desert.
Yep.
You know, growing up on the East Coast, no access to desert, moved to Colorado, and, you know, I can get there in four or five hours and just experience this whole different world, and it's really cool. If you guys are listening, like, I'm sure you've read Desert Solitaire, Marshall. Have you read that?
Yes, yes.
It's kind of a must-read just to, like, yep. prep yourself for seeing the desert and taking it in a different way. You got to read that, and then you got to visit. I'll take you out there. It's awesome. Okay, so let's move on. Death Valley, I would love to talk about this stuff all day. How about in all of your adventures and all of your travels, what is the weirdest or most unique wildlife experience that you've had?
I think it was probably in Australia when we did the Eco Challenge. We were in desert, and we finished out on the coast where we were in a rainforest, and the vegetation there, I mean, is just incredibly harsh. You know, everything out there in the rainforest has like thorns and is trying to protect itself, and so it's gonna, you know, you've got these vines hanging down with you know, jagged thorns that can rip you off your bike if you're biking, or, you know, will catch your pack if you're hiking. Plus then all the, I think there's seven of the most poisonous snakes that are in Australia, and we saw some boa constrictors. But I think the most unusual thing that we saw were, it's a bird, it's called a cassowary. Okay. I don't know if I'm saying that quite right. It's like an emu almost, only it's very, very colorful. And we saw one of these in the wild, and it had a baby chick alongside. And they can be very dangerous in that they have this sort of a claw of sorts, or their foot, where they can actually impale. One of the ways of defending themselves is they impale themselves in your chest and, you know, right through your heart. So you have to be careful, especially when they're protecting their young. So that's probably the most bizarre place. And then, of course, crocodiles and, you know, out on the Great Barrier Reef, paddling at the end was quite extraordinary in that, you know, you do just have all the color of the ocean.
Okay, I'm looking at the cassowary. That thing's scary, man.
Pretty wild, extremely colorful bird, but they, you know, they get pissed off pretty easily.
He looks like the dude from the first Jurassic Park that was eating, or trying to attack the Seinfeld guy. I forget his name.
Yep.
He looks like a dinosaur. Unbelievable. Yeah, that'd be a little scary. You know, monkeys typically aren't dangerous, but, you know, traveling in Southeast Asia and walking to dinner from hut to hut, and, you know, monkeys are climbing over your head, it always made you really nervous, you know, stuff like that. And alligator, you know, water's crazy because it's what you don't see that scares the crap out of you with water, you know?
Right.
Oh, yep. Man, those will destroy. Have you ever read the book River of Doubt, Marshall?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you got it. It's about Teddy Roosevelt, after he lost his last campaign, went on an adventure to the Amazon, and he hired one of the best explorers in Brazil to take him, and they were going to map out this tributary of the Amazon that had never been mapped before, and it was about his journey down there. But they go into detail with a lot of the wildlife. Pretty interesting.
Unbelievable.
Okay, so let me ask you, we're going to go down the line here, and this is going to be kind of like a quick hitter, okay? So a couple of sentences or opinions on it, okay? And this is, you're going to be telling yourself, you're going to be giving your, like, 25-year-old version of yourself some advice on all of these topics, okay?
Okay.
All right, what would you tell your 25-year-old self about aging?
Expect to go slower and be more methodical. Yeah, I don't know.
You know what? That's actually a great way to explain that. That's a very methodical answer. No, I'm just kidding. What would you tell your 25-year-old self about alcohol, drugs in general?
That there are other ways to gain highs, and that's getting out into the environment and nature.
Okay. What about relationships in general?
Relationships are the toughest. I think once you really take a hard look at yourself, then you will begin to understand where other people are coming from and be more empathetic.
Yeah, that's tough, I think, for everybody. money, what would you tell your younger version about money?
It's important only in that it affords you a better lifestyle, but gosh, I've just gone through, you know, a big, my mother just died and disinherited me just because I did what was exactly right. I don't want to go into a lot of detail, but she didn't agree with me, so she disinherited me. And it was all about money. So I would say do just the opposite. If you're comfortable living the lifestyle in the fashion and you know as well as you want to live, then don't let money be a factor at all. More importantly, do what is morally and ethically right that trumps money 100% of the time.
Awesome, man. I love it. Those are lessons. I don't know if I'm learning them at a higher rate than other people, but just doing the right thing regardless of the money is huge. What would you tell that version about politics?
You know, the most interesting, you know, I'll tell just a little story. When we would go out and adventure race, take, for instance, my buddy Mark Macy or Bob Haw or Lisa Smith Batch, and we never talked about politics in nature. And there's so much of that that is totally out of your control. As much as I can ignore politics, I think the better off I am.
Yeah, amen to that. parenting.
Parenting, the biggest thing is just spending time with your kids and taking the time to do it. And I made the mistake of not doing that as well as I should have, but pay attention to your kids because they grow up so quickly.
Yeah, awesome. And congratulations. I don't know. I can't remember if we said this on the air, but you said you're a new grandfather, right?
Yeah, I have a seven-month-old. His name is Caius, and baby boy, just beautiful thing. My first grandchild, and my oldest daughter is 37 years old, so it's damn well about time.
So, okay, for all grandparents and people like me who have parents that are grandparents, what can you tell us about being a grandfather versus being a parent that when you give that kid back at the end of the day, do you do a dance? Are you smiling? Like, when you guys leave us, what are you doing?
Well, you know, it's very hard to give him up. But then, you know, when he starts crying in the middle of the night or something, it's, you know, you can hear him off in the distance in another room or something. It's like, well, you know, this isn't so bad being a grandparent. But, you know, I might say also, and this is something that can I hope will strike home, is that, you know, I've always lived my life and continue to, or I anticipate living my life, you know, just being able to do things, you know, well into my, you know, 60s and 70s and 80s. I want to set a good example for those grandchildren. I want to be able to go out and hang with them.
Yeah, that's huge. So, well, of course they're too young, but I mean, that's got to be a huge goal moving forward. I mean, that could go to the aging piece, you know, take care of yourself. And my goal every day on my fitness, it's not to go climb mountains or run marathons or anything. It's so that I can wear my boys out when they're 17 and 18. Like,
there you go.
I need to be able to handle those kids still.
Fantastic. I love it.
All right. So we'll go a little bit into sports stuff. We're not wrapping up, but we are very close. Counting miles for runners. What would you say about counting miles? Do you have an opinion on that?
I used to do quite a bit of that. I would never keep track of it, but take, for instance, I set a goal of doing like 90 or 100 miles per week, sometimes up to 110 or more. I used to pay attention to that on a weekly basis, but I would never log it, and I'm glad I didn't because, you know, that's, you know, what are you going to do? Look back and say, well, you know, I did this or that. You know, that doesn't make sense to me. I think more than anything now, I just look at my watch and I'm going probably half the speed that I used to. And I just run by my watch. So, you know, if I went out for an hour when I was, 30 years old and I'd cover, you know, 9 or 10 miles, now, you know, I'll go out and, you know, do an hour and I might cover 4 or 5 miles, and that's okay. So I think running by the watch is very important. And, you know, if you're doing longer runs in particular, trying to get your body adjusted to burning fat, you know, if you go out for a couple hours, you know, the speed that you go really is not that important.
Yeah, I agree. So we'll talk about the ultra running thing just a little bit, because it's a segment of what you do. There's some cool things going on in the world of ultra running. There's some interesting things as well in the world of sponsorships and drug use and all that stuff. Do you have a take on doping or the idea that, you know, a lot of people probably are?
Yeah, you know, I think that's maybe I've got this sort of Pollyanna view of ultra running, but I don't think there's a whole lot of that going on. I like to think that there's not a whole lot of that going on. I think that, you know, particularly for endurance, if you train effectively and nutritionally, you're taking care of yourself, I don't see a huge need. And my greatest fear is that the long-term effects of something like that. So, yeah, I think I pay more attention to longevity. And instead of, you know, so I could be, you know, a superstar, you know, I think of Lyle Alzado, you know, the football player, you know, and it killed him.
Yep.
You know, and there are other people that, you know, I won't even, you know, I won't mention names or anything like that. But what is that doing to their overall long-term health? So, you know, is it really worth it?
Yeah, absolutely. So are there other sports besides the endurance sports that you have made a name for yourself in? When we go to like team sports, is there something that if you had to do it all over again, you would focus more time on in the team sport realm?
Well, you know, I particularly like the adventure racing. And what I liked about that is you had four or five individuals that you were traveling with, you know, over the course of, you know, 3 or 4, 100 miles and maybe a week or more. And the great thing about it was, you know, number one, if one of you, and it was, you know, sooner or later, it was going to be you that became the weak link. Everybody else would kind of prop you up and hold you up, and you could continue on. And the other neat thing is that, take for instance, if I wasn't that good of a paddler or I wasn't that good of a biker or something like that, there was always somebody who was better that could, you know, pull you along or, you know, kind of take up the slack. And then when it became your turn to do the same, you know, you do that gracefully. And I love that part about it, just that interaction of just helping each other out. And so I think adventure racing, I mean, it's just a great sport.
Who are a few athletes that if listeners don't know who they are, they should look them up and just check out their story?
Well, you know, I think one of the people that I always looked up to, you know, in the adventure racing world, just because he really was a student of the sport, and he was, you know, he's a phenomenal athlete, but, you know, he seemed to be very good at all the sports, and that's Mikey Closure, Mike Closure out of Vail. You know, I think, you know, he would deserve a look at. I'm sure you know of Ray Parang. You know, I think he's out of Wisconsin or something. You know, he's probably getting close to 70 years old, and he's still out there running, beating the pavement, and I mean, just doing extraordinary things, the consistency. And then, you know, my old favorite is Ted Corbett, and I talk a lot about him in my book. And incidentally, Ted Corbett, you know, who was in the Olympics, went to the Olympics back in the 1950s, was the one who coined the term ultra running.
Oh, wow.
He is the guy who made that label. Great. So, you know, he's an extraordinary athlete. Yeah, there's a number of them, you know, that are out there.
No, that's great. Yeah. I'll put that in the show notes so people can check those guys out. Marshall, where can people find Running on Empty, your book?
Well, they can just find it on my website. If they just Google my name, Marshall Ulrich, or Google, you know, Running on Empty, they can find it.
Okay.
If they really want to get quirky, they can get on Netflix and see Running America. And there's also the partner to that is Running the Sahara with our friend Ray Zahab.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a couple of movies out there also that are sort of interesting. And the neat thing about Running America is in 2008, when things were really crashing. I was running across the United States, and I just happened to finish, and it was serendipitously running down Broadway in New York City when Obama was being elected on Election Day. So, you know, it's kind of a sort of a cross section of what was happening across the United States at that time. So that's kind of a neat thing too.
Yeah. I've watched both of those. Those are both really fun watches. It's not just, you guys aren't just watching Marshall run with music in the background. There's some storytelling. It's pretty interesting. I had a good question, but it has left me for one moment. Oh, here it is. So this is one of our last questions for the listeners here. If people are listening right now, no matter what their fitness level is, literally if they can barely walk to their restroom, or if they are already running ultras, what is something they can do today to really challenge themselves physically and mentally that might not be a mainstream concept, like not just go run up a mountain? Like, what's something unique?
What's something unique?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a good question. You know, I think I'd have to be in that person's head and just sort of think, what is something that they would think that they might not do that may be a little bit more challenging? Like, you know, I don't know, maybe instead of driving to the grocery store that is 2 miles away, they walk over and walk back. You know, something as simple as that, something they wouldn't normally think of doing, but, you know, they could benefit from.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
that's an oversimplification.
No, I actually like that answer. It's just, you know, I have this concept I'm kind of throwing around in my head, and it's probably nothing new, but just the idea that adventure is a habit. It's a muscle that you have to work. And when you work on that muscle, you see the world in just such a different way. Like, you see a tree as a challenge. You see going to the grocery store as an adventure, like you just said, and just finding ways to make your everyday a little bit different. You know, me and my wife will be driving and I'll just say, okay, get out, see you at home. You know, like, just goofy stuff, but it can make the monotony, if you don't have resources like money to do things you think you want to do, it can make that monotony a lot more interesting. And that's kind of what I was tapping into. But
sure. Makes sense. Makes perfect sense.
Well, Marshall, I told you I'd keep it to a certain time on purpose, because I can talk all day long, but there's so many more stories. I know you have a book coming out in the fall, so maybe we can do this again in the fall, talk about the content of the book and really dive into that.
Yeah, that'd be great. The working title for it is Both Feet on the Ground. And, you know, what it is it's sort of a cross-section, and, you know, it kind of explores why it is that we're afraid to go out and do things, but encouraging people to indeed get out into nature and sort of rediscover, our basic instinctive nature.
Yeah, awesome. Well, what's the next physical thing that's interesting that you're doing?
Well, I'm going to go up and do the Arrowhead race, and then there's the 350-mile snow. It's not a snowshoe. It's on foot up in Alaska on the Iditarod Trail, so it's a 350-mile Iditarod Classic, I guess you'd call it, Invitational Classic.
Nice.
So I've got that in the pike. And to the end, if I can be successful doing that, I'd like to do the full-on 1,000-miler across Alaska on the Iditarod Trail in 2017.
Wow. What time of year are you going up?
Well, it's when the dogs run, so it's in February.
February, okay.
Yeah. As far as Badwater is concerned, you know, I did 20 of those, and it's like, man, I don't know. So this is kind of shifting gears into winter sports instead of always, you know, going out there in the desert and just dehydrating myself until I can't see straight.
That's kind of funny. Just how you said that so calmly, Marshall. Dehydrating myself till I can't see straight. I think I would have to go with you on that. Go for the cold a little bit. Enjoy it. It's a beautiful country anyway. Hopefully you'll see some interesting lights and all this stuff. But hey, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Scott. You've got a great show.
Thanks, man. You guys, if you're listening, Marshall actually knows Steve Segui from the Voyage into Hell series we're doing. They've run together multiple times, so go check out Steve's show, too. You guys can listen to two buddies here in the same day, even. And if you guys liked what you heard today, there's more on athleteonfire.com, and you can grab the app, Athlete on Fire, on any of your devices so you can just have the sucker streamed right to your phone. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you for listening to Athlete on Fire. Stay fired up with additional resources and information at athleteonfire.com.